Welcome back. As I mentioned, we need to find a new place for the fall, so if you could scout around and come up with some ideas, I'd appreciate it. We have one. Tom Healy said he would check on Unity downtown, North Delaware, but
he's suggested if anybody knows anybody.
You really think you do need a contact place?
And Smith, I'll do the contact.
Okay, CTS. God Best?
Oh, God Box.
God Box.
Inner City Church.
Inner City Church and JCC, First Baptist, 86th in College, St. Paul's.
What can we afford?
This size, I think 25 is fair. No, as you see, it's going to get smaller, so I hate to say a whole lot more, because by the end of the year, I want all my income going to church rent. Say 25. Or, I mean, they give us a break here for 10. And if they wouldn't have thrown us out, I would have given them a raise, but I'm not going to now. So. Yeah, I'll get that right. Yeah. No, I figure 25 for a group this size is fair. See, before we had like 4 or 5 people, and then I thought, you know, if you figure out what I...
Maybe it's good
enough. Humanity, I hope. Anyway, if you could come up with any ideas, I don't mind making the calls, but you just can't call a place cold. You almost need a contact. So, or if you know a contact and want to set me up to call them, I'll be glad to do
what
it.
What were you paying us in calls?
25. Yeah, but see, we had like 4 people, so that was awful, I thought.
But that was 25 each time or 25 a month?
I think it was 20. It started to be 25 a month, and then they raised it to 25 each time.
That really bugs me. Because yeah. All those people that did that are gone.
Yeah.
Good. Yes.
That was a nice place, I must say. It was really conducive for discussion.
Love it.
Yeah. St. Paul's. They have Lilly Libraries. Is that one? Robert's Library. It's really, and it's got a fireplace, and it's wood paneled, and it's really comfortable. So, just keep looking around for it, please. Quick review, and then we'll pick up. Just a moment to reflect on method, because I know we have a mixed group of mixed experience. Some of you have done a lot of this study, and some of you are just starting. And I know it's confusing. So I'd like to try to acknowledge how it's different, how our way of understanding things is different. And the normal way that we think is linear. And the linear thought process says, if this, then this, if this, then this. And it builds a consistent argument. It has to be logically consistent. Our method starts with an image. And rather than go linearly, we circumambulate. We look at it from different angles. But we're always at a point looking back to where we started. Where it can get confusing is if you're reading along, you suddenly realize there's no connection between what has just been said here and what's been said here directly. Here she may be talking about Thomas Aquinas. Here she may be talking about Albertus Magnus. Here she may be talking about the Greeks. And you say, huh? But the connection isn't to be made from comment to comment. The connection is to be made always back to the center. If you can keep that in mind, I think it'll be a lot heavier. If this is linear thinking, this is what I call associative thinking. It's not something they just made up. This is the way a dream thinks. This is the way the conscious mind thinks. This is the way the unconscious mind thinks. So not only are you learning new material, some of you, you're learning a new method. And I think it'll help if you don't try to see logical connections from one argument to the next. But you're able to always ask yourself, now, what image are we working on? And how is this an elaboration of that image? How is this an elaboration of that image? And so on.
It's also, you know, the way Jung writes. So if you understand this, you'll be a lot happier when you read Jung. People say he's illogical. He's not illogical. He's just using the dream logic. And honestly, I was trained in science, engineering, and then that wasn't linear. Then I went to theology, which makes that look like poetry. And I no longer can think that way. This is so much richer, I find. Because the problem with this way of thinking is that it doesn't have to be true. It just has to be consistent. Whether it has any relationship to reality is irrelevant. You pick a starting point, and then you go, and you never examine if what you're saying corresponds to reality. You only examine if what you're saying is consistent with what you said before. So it's the thinking of the inflated ego. But with this, you're always forced to go back to your starting point and say, what is it that I'm considering? And is this a reflection of this or not? This being the emotional reality that you're starting with. So I find it's much more fertile way to proceed.
In this book, what would you say the central point then is that it's always Sophia?
Well, we've had... I'm going to each time try to do that for you. Say, now here are the main points. I think we've had 1, 2, 3 main points so far. There are some smaller points, but the first main point was the wind and the hot wind. So we went a long way around discussing that, but we were always talking about the wind or its meaning. The second image, the second main image which we talked about, was the fact that Sophia was likened to something trodden in the mire. That was the second main image. And what she got out of that was that's the same description given to the alchemical, the product of the alchemical process. That when the alchemists complete the goal and they have this endpoint, which we call the lapis, that word's not that important, at this point, that the descriptions of that very often are that it's trodden in the mire. So that alerted us to the fact that we're not just dealing with a revelation of Sophia, but this revelation of Sophia is going to grip the person who's perceiving the revelation viscerally, and begin an emotional process of integration. And that emotional process of integration is symbolized in alchemy, by alchemy. So that introduced a dual theme, Sophia, and then the integration of Sophia. And the second, third main theme, which we're on, was the business of the Flintstone and the sparks. And we'll spend quite a bit of time on that today. Still. So if you get frustrated, if you get stuck, always stop and say, what's the main image we're working on? Yes, the overarching image is Sophia. And then all of these are characteristics of Sophia, you might say. The big point, two big points, three big points in that we'll be looking at under the image of the Flintstone and the fire and the sparks, is that idea that we focused on that Sophia is not totally understandable in personalistic terms. She is something bigger than what's in you. She's also in you, but she's also in a way which is hard to grasp rationally. She's also in the world. So she's the individual soul and she's the world soul. And I tried to give you an example, I don't know whether it worked for you or not, of this physicist whose dreams anticipated the events of our history, of our historical time. So that if you look at historical events and you look at dreams, you often see that they overlap. And this is, again, where we differ quite a bit from the traditional, I say Freudian, but I say that not just meaning Freud. If you've ever spent any time studying Freud, his basic worldview informs every psychology that exists, except Jungian psychology, as far as I know. And that basic assumption is you are what you experienced. Now, they all take that in different ways. They all try to solve the problems caused by that in different ways. But Jung is the only one that says not everything in you is there because you've experienced it. We are receptors for the psychological dynamics behind what is moving history. So our task in facing ourselves is not only facing our own personally created material. He doesn't deny that that exists, and that really is a large part of our work. But it's also confronting the part of our personality that is, so to speak, the emergence of historical dynamisms in our own personhood. And so you see, you can't go very far in this work without asking yourself, what's my relationship to the whole? Where do I fit in here? What am I to do here? Because just as the personal material represents your skills, your strengths, your emotions in your own personal life, this other dimension represents all those things as you interface with your society. That was something we made kind of a fuss over last time, in her observing that Sophia is not really personal. But I think we left off then on page 166, talking about the mind. And I hope that's clear. Let me just remind you. The the idea is that our understanding of the mind is a very late understanding of what the mind is. And I tried to explain that to you by link to the German language using the same word for mind and spirit. Geist, right. Originally, the mind was the organ that perceived the spirit. So the mind was originally a receptor for thoughts which, in their understanding, didn't come from yourself. They came from this spiritual dimension. And it's only really since the Enlightenment, I think, that we began to think of our mind as a set of operations that we set into motion. And what we're trying to do in our work is go back and recover that earlier sense of what mind is. Because you have to be able to receive Sophia's point of view. It's very much of a feminine operation. That's where we left off. Questions? Indigestions? Resentments? Joys?
Yes.
Well, what she then does there, 166, is just is just mention kind of the history of the understanding of mind as the vessel which receives, and reviews the history of this idea that understanding is a receiving of the inspirations which are thoughts. First she went to Avicenna, 166 to 167. He was a Muslim alchemist. And what he says is that this mind permeates the universe. Now that sounds so ridiculous, but before you throw it out, let's look at Jung's version of that concept, and that's the bottom of 167, absolute knowledge. If you have ever been moved by a synchronicity, I can think of people who were ready to shoot themselves, and something happened, which gave them a feeling, oh my God, something's going on here. And what one is left with in those moments is there's an intelligence here to have arranged this. Well, Jung doesn't quite know how to put that either, but he gives it a word and he calls it the absolute knowledge. That knowledge isn't something just in our organ of understanding. Knowledge exists apart from consciousness. And we see that in the fact of synchronicity.
Wouldn't a lot of people just consider absolute knowledge God? And that we just hear the word God? Not fundamental people, but...
Well, they might, but
and you say it permeates everything, and that's what many people
believe. Yeah, it sure is close. I think there's a slight distinction. I'm trying to think of it. For one thing, now this may not cause some people trouble, but it might cause other people trouble, is that it's bound up with the material world. That might cause some people trouble.
I think of God as being bound up.
Well, yeah. But you see, that's actually not kosher theology.
Yeah, so I'm fundamentalist.
Not even fundamentalist. I bet a good Catholic, a good traditional Catholic, and then, you know, if you really wanted to pick this apart, you're left with a problem with that formulation. Because if God is that knowledge which brings events together, did God bring Auschwitz together? Where do we separate?
Well, even fundamentalists believe that God created everything. So if God created everything, he created Auschwitz.
Well, see, I have a problem with that.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah, that's a tough one, the dark side of God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, basically I'd have to answer your question by yeah.
Yeah, God created everything, he created
people. Yeah.
Basically I have to say yes, but Jung doesn't speak our theological language. And he's trying to put this in a neutral language. Why? Well, this goes back to Pauli a little bit. I don't want to get us too far off, but I may have used this metaphor before, if I have, stop me. But imagine we're living in the 16th century. And everyone around us thinks the Earth is the center of the solar system. And somebody says to you, well, I read this article about the quantum. What's the quantum? You see, how do you begin explaining a fundamental shift in paradigm to somebody living in the old paradigm? Well, Jung's feeling is that we are living in a paradigm that is about to be superseded. So that we're like, if you use that analogy, we're like, if you put us in the Middle Ages, thinking that the Earth is the center of the universe, that's the level of our paradigm, but another paradigm is being generated which will come to fruition in about 500 years. We don't know what. Like, they couldn't have known what. And I think what Jung felt he was doing was he was trying to begin to lay the groundwork for that shift. Not that it's going to be ever made clear in our time, but that subsequent generations can come back and read, oh, this is where these guys were starting. See what I mean? So that's why he's using this neutral language, because he figures that religious language isn't going to be adequate to describing the phenomenology of the next worldview. That's kind of how I would sum it up.
See, I just, with Carl Jung, my pastor taught Jung. You know what I mean? So I had, like, he died 2 years ago. But it was 19 years with Jung and Edinger and all them, you know, and he definitely, like, he considered Jung one of the greatest prophets of our modern prophets
yeah.
of the time.
Well, so, that's my...
More spirituality, I don't know if it was, you know, necessary theology, you know, that, but he did, I mean, how he related everything to the Bible and brought that out, and mm-hmm. what Jung said was really, really phenomenal.
All I can tell you is it depends on what level you want to live on. If you find the religious language meaningful, then by all means, I think you could say that absolute knowledge is, I'd say, more like the Holy Spirit. But if you are not living in that religious language, then there's Jung is attempting another vocabulary. Why? Well, because he figures the new paradigm is going to need a new vocabulary. And it's such a vast shift that we don't know where it will go. And sometimes I feel even stupid saying this, because it sounds so almost flaky. But then if you go back and you look at the history of science, there are these huge paradigm shifts. And there was one from 1500 to now. Why wasn't there going to be another one between now and 2500? And I think what we're seeing in this unconscious material is the first surfacings of that new paradigm. And that's why he's attempting to come up with a new language.
Well, I think it makes sense for him not to use religious language,
yeah.
because it doesn't sound scientific to begin with.
Yeah, he's trying to be scientific.
He always said, I'm a doctor. I'm not a theologian. I
yeah.
that.
He's trying to be empirical. He's trying to show us facts and then link that up with a language that is hopefully at some point going to be investigatable. And I just think that's what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it hard to understand, but he's really writing for the future. In that. So anyway, back to the idea that remember my little Pegasus story? Those events came together, and it is as if there is a knowledge bringing them together. Understanding then is that same process of knowing in myself. So my mind, in this view, My mind is a particularization of the world's mind. So that's just a historical background. Then she looks at Thomas Aquinas' view of the same thing, and he changes that a little bit. That's on 168. He says, by the way, that the phrase that we're talking about is intellectus agens, I guess you pronounce it. And Avicenna had one idea. And Thomas's idea was that it wasn't simply a cosmic principle. It was also a principle of the soul. This mind.
This phenomenon.
Sorry?
Cosmic and soul to me are synonymous.
Well, by soul, of course, he's using soul in the religious sense of this part of ourselves that is eternal.
It doesn't have to be religious. It just has to be a knowing.
That's fine. The point that she wants to make is just to show how over the history of time this mind has gone from a general to a personal. And then personal to mental. That's all. It's not a real big deal, but I did want to touch on it. But if you've studied any modern philosophy, you see this flies against everything. Because the rage today is postmodernism, that everything is a point of view. And that may be the case, but Jung is saying there's a knowledge beyond a point of view.
There is.
Yeah. And what we try to do in our work, then, is open ourselves up to that.
Is this point of view stuff considered self-objective?
That's so interesting. I mean, it's such a joke. Pardon me. It is objectively true that there are no objective truths. That's their starting point. See what I mean? It's a logical fallacy from the beginning. But it informs all art criticism, all historical criticism, not all, but all popular art and historical criticism. And there are postmodern Jungians, you know, who say that this is just Jung's take. And everything you say is just your take. I was working with a couple who was saying one of these postmodern, feminist therapists, and who kept saying that, you know, he had her point of view and she had his point of view, until he punched her in the face. I said, now whose point of view is that? See what I mean? It can't. In a way, it's true. We do interpret subjectively, but that doesn't mean that there's no objective knowledge.
That's sort of my point.
And what science has tried to do is develop a methodology to get to that objective knowledge. And we still have to realize there's a subjective room for error, but there are ways to try to eliminate that error. This gets off a little bit, but
would you say that logical fallacy again?
It's objectively true that there are no objective truths. Well, they don't say it that way. They say there are no objective truths. There are only subjective interpretations. But I always want to think them. So you're telling me it's objectively true?
Crazy.
Pardon me?
That allows knowledge to go crazy.
That allows the world to go crazy.
It's getting there.
Yeah. Oh, read the news and listen to chic art dialogues. This is the reigning paradigm. You can no longer say what's art and what's not art. It's because it's all a point of view. Mm-hmm. Everything's art. Graffiti's art. Well, since what? About since the war, maybe. Since World War II. You know. Anyway, I don't want to get on that too much. But it does to me, maybe this hasn't hit you like it hit me. It struck me so strongly that knowledge isn't only in me. Now, that's about all we can say for sure. What is in me, what is not in me, I don't know. But the implications here is that there is some mind beside my mind. Some people would call it God. Jung prefers not to use that language. He just gives it a word. He calls it absolute knowledge. We may only know it subjectively. That doesn't mean that it is a subjective reality. Okay. This might be a place just to put a little pause. I talked to somebody who had a dream about the class. Kind of. Want to talk about it?
Yeah.
Okay.
A dream about this class? Well, that's what he said.
Since he doubted you.
I wasn't saying.
She agreed.
No,
she agreed. She agreed.
I wasn't at the last class, but I guess in terms of some feedback, other feedback that he had, it related.
Yeah, some other folks said to me, how do we... Well, they didn't say it this way, but as I summarize the question, how do you make use of this knowledge that we're talking about? I thought it might be good just to spend a minute on that. Probably should have started off the class with it, but it just occurred to me as we were talking here. So you want me to tell your dream, or do you want to do it? Or?
No, I can tell it.
Okay.
I had a dream that a woman, wonder who she is, married a man of ideas, and he had an infant that she was helping care for, and then she married him. And they had to go on a mission to spread these ideas, but they couldn't do that with the baby, so they had to give the baby away, and they gave the baby to her parents, and her parents had limited resources, and they still had an 11 or 12 year old daughter at home, so they had to send her away to someone else to care for, and she was sent away without her doll and was distraught. And so the infant, the child, the doll are all, of course, the idea of the soul. That when you marry yourself to ideas, that it sets in line a chain reaction where people begin losing their souls, and that's the effect that you have on others. And I could relate to it very well because at age 11, we moved a lot when I was a kid. And at age 11, we moved away from a place that I felt really held meaning for me. And I, in effect, lost my doll, I think. It took a long time to get back to her. But we talked about this a lot in terms, I have to wait, talk to Gary about it. The next day, it occurred to me that it had so much to say about what's happening in our world and in the prisons in Iran. That how do things like that happen? Well, people get married to ideas and they give away the child, they give away the baby, and then another child gets displaced and that child loses her soul. And it just becomes, it's a matter of, this is kind of like a pet peeve, people running red lights. I mean, there are laws in place to help us all get along better in society and not have wrecks and not be angry drivers, and what happens when you run that red light, which is so rampant? There's a chain reaction that happens because of that, even if there's not a wreck, and all of those things build, and it makes me think a lot more. It slowed me down and made me start thinking about the impact of the things that I say and do in everyday life. If I get married to ideas and somebody loses their doll.
Yeah, thanks. I thought it was relevant to you and to all of us, and you weren't the only person that had this concern, either consciously or unconsciously, so let's spend a minute on it. Because we're talking about ideas here. And what do you do with them? Well, you can get stoned on them. And live in the ideas and forget what they refer to. Now, I know full well that what we are talking about are just the ideas, not the experiences. People have said to me, well, you're just a head tripper talking about all this intellectual stuff, but this is just the view extracted from those experiences. I know full well these aren't the experiences. So what that means for you is to realize that we're just talking about the structure of our experience, and this isn't our experience. I would encourage you not to live in these ideas. I think that's the danger of the dream, that you live in these ideas and then you forget what your own experience is. The way I work with this material is I learn it and then I put it on the back burner. And I would encourage you to, you know, if you're really interested in the inner journey, be working on your own dreams and forget about this stuff. But once in a while, you'll have a dream, say, of starlight. And you can think, oh, Sophia. And then you can go from that dream to what you learned about Sophia. But it would be a mistake to live in that knowledge of what we're talking about here and forget that it is its purpose is really to help you understand your inner experience. I just wanted to try to clarify that I don't assume that learning this material turns you into a whole person. These are just the thoughts that we've extracted from, well, she's extracted, and I'm trying to share, from a lot of these experiences, but the thoughts aren't the experiences. And if you get carried away with the thoughts, then you lose the experiences. That's what I thought that the dream was warning us about. So just to let you know, I'm aware of what the issue is, and to encourage you to enjoy this, enjoy the thoughts, but also then don't forget about your experience. And really go from your experience to the thoughts. Don't go from the thoughts to your experience.
Are there ways to bring that sort of feeling-based perspective to the material?
Yeah. It's sort of up to you folks. Each class I do is different. It's funny, I did Anatomy of the Psyche a couple of times. We just finished it, John and Sandy were in it. And I had no idea how it was going to go. I don't know if you know that book. It's a summary of the alchemical symbolism. And it's grouped by major themes. It's what, about 10 different chapters, I think, 10 different themes. And after about the second class, we started to get to know each other a little bit. People would bring in the dream about the very image we were talking about that morning. And so we started off the class with that dream. And then we could take all the stuff we have learned and show how it related back to the dream. So if anyone wants to share a dream from what we're talking about here, I would encourage you to do that. If you want to play it safe, email it to me first. And I'll look at it, because sometimes we can, you know, see, is it going to get you in too deep water that you don't want to get into here? It's just a thought. I mean, I don't want this to be a therapy hour, but there's no reason we can't look at some dreams that you've had dealing with these themes. And I've given you that index in the back of all the major images, so that's a possibility. The reason I went through the dreams at the beginning was to give you a starting idea for what this looks like practically. But I'm more than happy if you want to bring in your own dreams, and we'll talk about them at that point. So if you had a wind dream, if you had a hot wind dream, if you have a star dream, you'll see other images coming up. We can talk about it and show how this is relevant to that dream. I will try to keep it from getting too personal, that we're not talking about your own issue, but how the themes in your dream make more sense when you know this material. So just want to, I thought it would be useful to spend a little time on how do you receive what we're doing here. Because I can feel, see, we're already, we're getting into some vast topics, absolute knowledge. And last time we talked about history and so on, and you can think, oh my God, you know. But that's not the way to think about it. The point to think about is, where are your own dreams today, tomorrow, and once in a while, they'll pop over in this direction. Then you can use this material to help you understand.
I guess I was thinking a little more in terms of what Carol's been able to do for us and mm-hmm. bringing some of her paintings mm-hmm. and talking about them. I don't know. I know I've been in some other classes where we'll kind of have an assignment to make something that embodies somehow what we've been talking about or what you discussed in this time. I'm just throwing that out there.
What I'd like to do is leave it to the unconscious. Now, she, all those things came out of her unconscious. She didn't intend to think. But that's what happened. The other class that we just finished, Number in Time, you think this is bad. You should have seen that one. It was the worst thing I've ever done. And it was so abstract. And then she started painting these pictures of images of the theories we were talking about. And we could feel the image. We could feel the theories. That was an enormous contribution. She may start doing that here, too. You never know. But as I say, each class has its own personality. And if you do feel like making something, that drawing a picture, that's fine. I hate to give that as an assignment. But we may have to give ourselves the space to find our own way into an emotional relationship with this material. I am aware of that.
Well, Sick, I am, but I don't share it at all. I think this is where we're kind of getting, so I'm not sure where the boundaries are.
Yeah,
you know, as far as...
I think we only know by trial and error.
Right. I'm kind of going through, because this is, everything is very experiential
mm-hmm.
and kind of helping me define my experience with Sophia in a lot of ways. In much more grand language than a terminology, mm-hmm. however, simplifying it to where I can relate it or integrate it into my own life.
So, you know, I've been doing a lot of searching on the internet and reading, finding other people's images of Sophia and reading other people's takes on it. And I even have a couple books that one of my, I loaned to you earlier that are more into, Sophia as the Black Goddess and more as the transformative underground journey kind of thing, like the Kali or something like that. And I've been working on a drawing of her too, but it's like you're weaving these different things because we've got Aurora Insurgents, but then I've got some other stuff that I'm weaving into it too. So it's we all just kind of are finding a lot of websites and a lot of information.
Well, if you feel like sharing it, too. And I'll try to receive it and also not have it take up all our time.
Also, I got some tapes from the library that were from a seminar in 1992. It was for James Hillman or something like that at Notre Dame. And they were talking about Sophia in 1992 as the image of the new millennium.
Interesting.
That long ago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just had one floor chance here.
Yeah.
I did a writing, and it got published in Eagle's Vision as mm-hmm. one of the, as part of the group that I'm involved with on the internet. And they actually gave me front page on Reflections of Sophia.
What's it called?
I named it. I titled it Reflections of Sophia.
Would you want to maybe make us a copy next time?
Oh, sure. Now, this is coming from my own religious, this is my own experience of it, but...
Do you have...
You're actually in here, Gary.
Uh-oh. you have our email addresses, right? Could you forward it to each of us?
Yeah. And it's just a short thing. You know, that's my own experience. And they actually published it, and she sent me the thing. So
very
I was honored. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's nice to have other people's input.
Absolutely.
What they're getting out of it, because it's... You know, it helps.
Yeah.
Her paintings, your writing.
It's so important to find a way to bring it to your experience.
You yourself, yeah. And kind of refreshing your own.
And I love Carol's painting. The one she brought last week, there was one that had the web.
Yeah.
That was really with this Spider Lady or whatever, Spider Woman.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. Talk to her a little bit about that.
Okay. I just wanted to address that I'm aware that we can take this as an opportunity to find our own relationship to it. Okay. We left off then 170. Luminosity is the word. The middle of the page, the beginning of the third paragraph on that page. The concept of the intellectus agens also coincides psychologically with Jung's concept of luminosity, of archetypal contents in the unconscious. Jung comes to the conclusion that the archetypes, in conformity with the cosmic function of the nous means mind, the mind of God, you might say, Mus would be the religious language for that absolute knowledge. Must possess a non-psychic or psychoid aspect which even causes them to appear as ordering factors in the physical space-time continuum. I thought we could look at that sentence a little bit. Let me explain it to you, and then I'd like to give us another little detour to take a look at Jung's concept of the archetype. So we'll go to a little bit of Jung 101 here, or actually Jung 201, probably. The idea is that consciousness isn't limited to the ego. There is a consciousness in the unconscious, and there's a consciousness in the external world. What we'll look at first for the moment is the knowledge or the consciousness in the unconscious. Jung, now you all know what a complex is. Everybody? Sure? Doubly sure? Okay. If you look at your dream images, that's a portrait of your unconscious. And those dream images stand for various parts of your unconscious personality. So if you have a regular neighbor dream, or a regular old boyfriend, girlfriend dream, or dog dream, that would be a piece of your unconscious symbolized by that image. Yeah.
I have a question. These characters that we put in our dreams that are people that we have known that just keep showing up year after year in places, are we picking those because they are archetypes to us of a certain thing? They're not really the person, or
probably aren't really the person,
but more what they stand for.
What they stand for. Now that's true about 80% of the time.
What about the other 20?
Well, they represent the person that you dream of. Mm-hmm. It's hard to distinguish.
What about places?
Same. Well. Those sub-personalities, those parts of the unconscious, Jung calls complexes. It's just a word for your inner man, your inner woman, your inner car, whatever part of you. Well, we're living in a driven society, you know. People have got an inner car.
very, very strong.
It's raining in here. Yeah, that's what people are looking at.
It is.
Yeah, water's dripping down from the ceiling.
Sign of something.
That's actually not Jung's word. That's Freud's word. Oedipus complex. With Freud, that unconscious is dumb. And the job of consciousness is to make it conscious.
You mean dumb, dull, or dumb can't speak?
Dumb, independent intelligence. It's simply a piece of yourself that you've stuffed away, and it's not anything but a refuged part of yourself. A refuge part of yourself. Now, Jung doesn't agree with that. He finds that those complexes also have a consciousness.
But they have a life of their own.
They have a life of their own, exactly.
Example. I don't know whether anybody has it, but there are at least a half a dozen houses in my dreams for years that I know as well as any house I've ever lived in. I have our own furniture.
Mm-hmm.
They're perfectly familiar. Never been in any of them.
The
like them all.
Good.
The houses are, they are an extension of self.
Right.
There are things about myself I like.
They are portraits of different aspects of yourself. Mm-hmm. And
why does my car have bad brakes?
Maybe he doesn't know when to stop.
Or why do you drive? I remember wondering, I think Bob had something about driving into a lake. The road went into the lake and kept driving into the lake. And I thought, oh my gosh. But, you know,
that's a repetitive dream. You get to the bottom of this hill that the road used to go through, and now there's a lake there, and you have to stop and back up this hill to a point where you can turn around. And keep forgetting.
Okay, let's take that. Hello. Let's take that lake. Now, that's a good example. Let's take that lake. Now, what would a Freudian say about that? A Freudian would say, well, you see, that is...
the mother.
Yeah, that is some aspect of yourself that is... interfering with your life.
Oh.
Okay?
Yes.
Now, what Jung might say is, do you need that interference? Is that interfering image there because it knows you need it to be there? Not making up a completely hypothetical idea, but I could give you probably... tell you similar stories, not necessarily in these images. Let's suppose you're about to invest money in the stock market. And that night you have a dream that you're driving along and that lake's in front of you. You wake up.
So you have to turn
around and go back. You might say to yourself, maybe I should not invest that money. The next day you find out that the market crashes. So that lake image was actually more intelligent than you were. That's what Jung means by luminosity of the unconscious. These images often appear purposefully. Sometimes it could be, let's say, that you're... That you are too tied to your parents, and every time you try to do something, you run into that dependence, and that's what that dream means. It could very well mean that. And a Freudian would take that dream and say, you see, that's a repressed Oedipal issue, and the dream is a portrait of what you don't know about yourself, and you need to become aware of it.
It could very well be both.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking about, you were tying in someone being too tied to their parents with the lake in front of the road.
Could be, because the lake's a mother symbol.
Oh.
You see that you're running into your mother complex. And that is part of your unconsciousness. And you need to make that conscious and recognize your how you continue running into your mother complex, huh?
The dependency on the mother.
For example.
So you've just given us
two totally different examples.
Okay. Because, see, I had the same dream, only it's not repetitive. I'm
But you can be anything.
Yeah.
Depends on what's going on. But the point I want to leave you with is how that dream image sometimes can be a portrait of what you are unaware of and is getting in your way. And sometimes it can represent a knowledge far superior to anything you have. And it's really not a picture of one of your problems. It's an intelligent statement from within you, from a place beyond your intelligence. So that's what Jung means by the luminosity, the knowledge, the intelligence of a complex. These complexes are not only dumb. Sometimes they are. But sometimes they are conveying an enormous intelligence. That's why Sophia is symbolized by starlight. Those points of light represent the knowledge that the unconscious has, which is beyond your knowledge. And Sophia is that knowledge of your true selfhood. Now, originally, Jung took his... I'm going to go a little bit over if I can, and we'll take a break. I'm going to finish this thought. Jung originally defined archetype as a pattern of behavior. And so these dream images he took as representative of patterns of behavior. So we took the first lake example as the pattern of the behavior of your dependence. But he began to realize that these images sometimes, as we just said, have an intelligence greater than yourself. The classic example, he used to say, was he had a guy who had a phobia of stairs. Stair phobia. Could you think of a more banal, repressed symptom? They couldn't solve it. They gave up. Jung later found out the guy moved to South America. He got caught in a gunfire, and realized, now is the time I have to overcome my phobia and run up these steps to safety. All the way up the steps, he was shot. Okay. See, that phobia knew.
Stay
off the stairs. So that's what got Jung thinking. These symptoms, these images, these complexes, sometimes are pathological, and sometimes they contain hidden intelligence. That hidden intelligence is the luminosity.
Isn't that something of an assumption, though? I mean, for Jung to assume that that's what that was about, all this whole phobia all his life was about.
Well, it's a mighty big coincidence if it's not.
You think so? Mm-hmm. I mean, okay. It doesn't seem like one to me, but... somebody be shot as they ran up the stairs. It doesn't seem like it would have to be that big of a coincidence to me.
I don't see how it couldn't be, but anyway.
It wouldn't be a coincidence if he hadn't had the phobia, of course.
Right. It would not have been a coincidence had he not had the phobia. Right. That's a graphic example, but we see this all the time where dreams look like there's something wrong here, you know.
He could have gotten shot anyway. I guess that's what I'm thinking. I mean, a coup's dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're in a coup, maybe he would have gotten shot if he had not been.
Okay, I understand you don't buy this. But what? Then that's not what my argument hangs on. I was just giving that as an illustration. What I can leave you with is those dreams we see, and such a dream is not out of the ordinary. That you would be going to invest in the stock market, have a dream, you go into a lake, you wake up, you decide not to invest, and you realize 2 days later that was just the right decision, and that the dream somehow did have a knowledge beyond yourself. What I'm getting into is how Jung then widened his understanding of what an archetype is. From a pattern of behavior to that inner psychological part that is giving rise to that behavior, possessing a deeper knowledge. Then, one more thing, and we'll take a break. Beginning to realize that these this phenomenon of greater knowledge doesn't only happen in dreams. It also happens in the body and in the physical world. so that the archetype again got reevaluated. And he was forced to realize the archetype, which he started out saying is a psychological pattern of behavior, ends up being something that is much more than psychological. The word he gave to that was psychoid. Now what I've done, I've just introduced the whole argument to you. We'll go back, we'll take a break, we'll come back, and we'll read through how his ideas developed. And I wanted to take what this Sophie material challenges us to realize and just give you a chance to see how his own ideas and one of his concepts developed over the course of his life. Yeah.
I'd like to jump in on the body thing that you were talking about. I do body work along with counseling, and year after year, people who've had losses, the body's like heck when they come in. I just had a lady a month ago who lost her son 5 years ago from that weekend. I saw her on Tuesday. I couldn't remember when she had the loss, and then when she left, she said, "Oh, by the way, my son died 5 years ago this Sunday." I called her back. It hit me that the body was telling her, "Grieve, grieve, grieve," and she's very stoical. And your intellect and your feeling. I called her back and I said, "Hey, be aware."
And we can talk a little more about this, Lena, because what Jung is coming to at points is that knowledge in the body isn't only a holdover from the past, but it's a predictive of the future.
Harbinger,
exactly. So let's take a break and then we'll proceed with a little further.